every Friday night after the League of Ireland games, a place for you to come to give your opinion, to vent. And there's a little button down on the left-hand corner where you can say that you want to talk.
Catch League of Ireland Late Night, Friday nights at 10 on Twitter Spaces. Follow at Off the Ball.
We can talk about the rebirth of Timo Werner as an important constituent part of Chelsea's bid to try and win the Champions League and the FA Cup. We can talk about Liverpool's B team looking pretty good. We can talk about the situation at Manchester United. But I did want to start by talking about club ownership generally and the opportunity that is there right now for football in England to say, maybe we've got this wrong. Maybe now is an opportunity for us to revisit how we run football in this moment of global crisis, to say, actually, the fan ownership model that they have in Germany looks pretty good, and we're going to institute that. It's going to be difficult. It's going to be a bit of a legal minefield, but we're going to do it because it's the right thing to do. There's no one is coming forward and saying, now's the time for us to seize the football clubs and return them to the people.
No, because, I mean, legally, it would be very difficult to remove what the law considers private property from someone. That's obviously not easy to do, but ultimately the law can do anything if Parliament votes for it. So it probably is possible in theory, but I very much doubt there's a will, because, I mean, partly there's lots of other stuff going on, but also if they don't do it, no one will do anything. No one will not vote for a particular party because they don't hand the football clubs back to the people. But of course, the football clubs morally always, the ownership resides with the people to begin with. The problem is that it's a bit like what's going on in a way with tech, where tech is developing faster than legislation is able to keep up with it. Although, again, because there's so much money involved, there's not a massive will to legislate there either. And I think the same happened with football, is that people realised how much money there was to be made in English football before the authorities did. And the authorities didn't really care anyway. So, for example, like, I guess to choose an example at random, Roman Abramovich buying Chelsea. At that point, I guess it was sort of in the very early days of the internet, particularly. So no one was really sure who Abramovich was, or at least the tools to find out who Abramovich was and the information as to who Abramovich was not available to everyone, and not everyone cared that much. It was just, this billionaire's buying Chelsea and now they're going to buy everything. I don't think, and I can only talk for myself, I mean, I wasn't asking the same questions about Abramovich that I'd be asking now, because I wasn't used to it. I didn't have the information available. I've educated myself, I guess, since then. However, the people making the decision should, even at that point, back in 2003, have said, who is this man and why does he want to buy Chelsea? And the story that we were told, I mean, it sounds quite funny now, that he was captivated and charmed by United's game against Real Madrid that finished 4-3, where Ronaldo scored a hat-trick. That game, he was so captivated by that, that he felt he had to go and spaff some millions on a football club. I mean, it sounds absolutely ludicrous now, and it should have sounded ludicrous then to the people that were in charge, but it didn't. And that was kind of the moment where people began to realise that actually owning football clubs had political capital as well. And we don't, even to this day, know necessarily why Abramovich bought Chelsea. I've seen articles written suggesting that no one knew who Roman Abramovich was before that. And the friends of Vladimir Putin were developing a habit of meeting unusual ends. So once Roman Abramovich bought Chelsea, lots of people in the world knew who he was. So suddenly, if someone that owns this English institution disappears and he's in London at the time, then actually that's much harder to do than when he's just some faceless billionaire. That'd be one thing. The other reason I've seen advance, particularly in recent days, is that it was part of a plot. And Vladimir Putin wanted Roman Abramovich to buy Chelsea as part of what's going on with the insertion of Russian oligarch capital, particularly into the city of London, but generally around the world, so that all these things are webbed up in each other. And you see that it's much harder to sanction when Russian money is so bound up in the government and particularly the Tory party. That is a very long answer to say that, yes, football clubs should be owned by the fans, but we've got a situation now where they're owned by people with whom one would not necessarily want to go for a pint.
Yeah, we should point out that Abramovich has obviously denied that this is part of a request from the Kremlin to get involved in that. But you can see how people are making the leap that integration of Russian money with the political system in England is exactly having that impact of slowing down the sanctions, in particular against those billionaires. Now, it is interesting when you talk about the ability legally to seize the club. Yesterday, Germany decided they were going to take Alistair Usmanov's super yacht. It's worth $600 million. Obviously, Chelsea's worth a significant amount more. But in legal terms, the boat, the club, their assets, there's definitely a mechanism there. They're seizing assets or they're freezing assets. Really, Chelsea should be frozen as an asset, and Roman Abramovich shouldn't be able to write off the debt for the public acclaim that is going to come. You know, I want one last tour of Stamford Bridge. That's going to be an amazing moment for him, where the crowd is like, oh, you gave us 1.6 billion of your own cash to allow us to have the decade and a half of success. Like, that's going to happen.
That's not strictly true, I don't think, in that, irrespective of whether you say the cash that Abramovich has is strictly speaking his, I mean, Forbes magazine called what he did something like the largest corporate heist in history. So there's that, but there's also the fact that the purchase price that Abramovich has put Chelsea for sale at will include every penny he's put in, he's going to get back. So he has sort of put money into Chelsea, and I totally understand but why Chelsea fans feel...
Sure, warm. But that's not what he's saying. And what I'm saying is he's getting the PR hit from this, and he's getting the PR hit from this because they haven't frozen his assets. What they should have done is they should have stepped in and frozen his assets, and then that nice email that he wrote to the Chelsea fans, a love letter to the Chelsea fans, which he's going to get reciprocated by them. Like, I'm already seeing the Chelsea, whatever you say or whatever you think about him, he changed the history of our club and delivered untold success, like unparalleled success for Chelsea.
And this is it, isn't it? It doesn't matter what you do as long as my football club gets to dance around with some silver pots every now and again, or more often than that. And that shows us very specifically how people feel towards their football clubs. There's nothing like it. And it took, the only thing that's surprising is how long it took a panoply of terrible people to realise that the best way of communicating with the widest possible number of people across borders, across classes, across races, across religions, across sexes, across sexualities, was football. There is no single thing in the world that is able to contact as many people as football, and most particularly English football. If you think about even music, for example, this enormously wide, diverse, popular thing, it can be quite region-specific. That in particular countries, they like particular kinds of music, they like local music. If you go to any country in the world, you might hear some American music or some English music, but you will generally hear local music more than anything else. However, if you go to any country in the world, you will see European football, and particularly English football, are all over the place. And there are no barriers. You couldn't say, well, the only people that like it are this. So there's no religious reason not to like football. It's not something that only men like or only women like. It's this one thing, and there is nothing like it. I'll say it again. There is nothing like it in terms of crossing borders and allowing you to be able to speak to people, to tell people things, to make their minds up, to control them in some ways. And for the same reason, that is why Roman Abramovich's name was getting sung last night. You would hope that at some point there would be a reckoning for Chelsea fans. It doesn't have to happen in public, where they're not going to give back all the joy that they've experienced since Roman Abramovich bought Chelsea, but where there is at least some reflection as to the provenance of that joy and the provenance of that wealth and the provenance of that success. Because bad stuff has happened for that success to happen. And your football team winning things is, I mean, it's important. I say it to someone, some of the greatest days of my life have been spent watching Manchester United win things, not win things, lose finals, whatever. The whole experience of all of that have been some of the greatest times of my life. But it doesn't mean that I abandon every other sense of morality that exists in my world in order to enjoy the success of a particular football team. And however much our football team is bound up in our identity, what should be bound up in our identity even more profoundly is our sense of right and wrong. And there are owners of football clubs in England and across the world whose very existence in football, whose very existence as powers in our world, should massively infringe our sense, our personal individual sense, and our communal sense of right and wrong. And there's no getting away from that.
And I agree with you. I agree with everything you said. I guess my case is that what's happening here is an opportunity for everybody to realise that it has reached epidemic proportions. What's going on with Newcastle, what's going on with Manchester City, what's going on at various other stages. Almost all of the big clubs have had somebody injecting money or taking money out who you're kind of going, is there not now an opportunity for a grassroots movement like there was that killed the European Super League to say we need to revisit the whole notion of fan ownership and let's start with Chelsea, but let's move through this. Let's just move through football. Like
I would love that to happen. And I think one of the problems, the reason why the European Super League protest works is I think partly there was a very clear, very fixed target, and it was, the threat was imminent. It was right there. If you don't act right this second, your game is gone. So people did it. I also think that there was a banner to unite behind. When those 2 days happened, I was on the Guardian blog that time. So all day I was basically doing, it felt like a funeral. I felt, and then at the end of the day where I just felt exhausted and spent, I remember Monday Night Football was on and I watched Gary Neville and Jamie Carragher. And after I watched them, like the righteous indignation, and it just felt like there was a movement. And it, without their contribution of those two, it may have happened because there was enough anger and it was ridiculous enough and badly planned enough. But it felt like those two became the leaders of the resistance who are able to unite everyone. And one of the problems we've had long had in English football is that the rivalries are too intense to enable fans to band together to fight against the common enemy. Because the common enemy really, as a Manchester United fan, isn't Liverpool and Manchester City really at this point. It's the Premier League, it's FIFA, it's UEFA, it's the government. That is the common enemy of football fans. I mean, that's the common enemy a lot of just people, but that is a common enemy of football fans. And in Germany, they've always been really good at this. They made sure, for example, that free-to-air highlights would be available at a sensible hour because they protested. The 50+1 rule, the sponsorship deals, you get them because fans, when they band together, are a huge body. When it's just Man United fans singing Die Die Glazer, that might work in a very short term, but it's not going to persuade any government to sit up and take notice because it's not possible to cause enough aggravation and it doesn't represent enough voters. But I agree with what you say that it is absolutely time. It's long since time. But what it will take, I'm now thinking more about practicalities. What will it take for that to happen? And it will take associations of supporters group, particularly the big clubs, and particularly of the clubs who have the most dreadful owners. But don't imagine Newcastle fans want to be part of that. Don't imagine Manchester City fans will be part of that either. They don't want to kick out their owners because their owners are making things very nice for them. And although they're making things not quite as nice for people who are discriminated, persecuted against and enslaved in their countries, murdered in their countries, they are bringing better football to the Etihad and St James's Park. And people feel quite attached to that. And I say it in that kind of way because I'm taking the piss because I am taking the piss, but I also understand very profoundly how pleasurable it is to watch that, to watch good football, to go to a football ground every other Saturday or every Saturday, go away every other Saturday and know you're going to be entertained, know it's going to be a buzz. I understand this more profoundly than my wife would like me to. I get it. But the problem is that most people ultimately do not care about this, and the clubs who are afflicted with the worst owners City are currently afflicted with the most success, and those two things are connected. And bringing about that change, there is no will for change in a lot of places, and that is a massive problem. Whereas the Super League, everyone hated that. Everyone was opposed to that. There was a banner behind which to unite. Powerful figures supported it, and that's what happened. But changing owners, not so much.
Theoretically, then, if there was a better version of a Super League, a less kind of formatically bad version of the Super League, if that came along and existed, do you then think it would be met with the same set of uproar? Like, for example, if the Super League existed and it was unquestionable that the fortunes of Arsenal or Tottenham would benefit from being in a Super League, which you could possibly argue the original thing was, do you then think that there would be the same level of uproar, or do you think that they would fall in line just like Newcastle United fans have fallen in line and Manchester City fans have?
It depends, I think, because the thing with the Super League, it was the actual process of watching your team every week in a closed shop is not better, because and no club could go into a Super League and say, well, we're definitely going to win this every year. So, because the other teams are just as rich as you are, if not richer. So I don't think it's quite as simple as that. And the Super League basically messes with the real, like the fibre of football, that suddenly you're not playing the clubs that you've spent the last 120 years hating and building rivalries with. At that point, it just exists as a TV thing in order to make money for people. And then it ceases to become a local issue, which is sport. And the localism in sport, I think, is more powerful than the internationalism. Beating the people that live on your doorstep is more attractive than beating people who live in other parts of the continent. That's a treat. So we see it. We saw it with the Champions League at the turn of the century. They moved the Champions League to, they made two groups, ultimately because they wanted more TV dates, fixtures, and it didn't work because it was just too much. It was overkill. And I think that's one of the problems with the Super League, is that aside from all the other reasons with the Super League, if you look at it just purely as a sporting endeavour, it didn't tick enough of the boxes that you would like a sporting endeavour to. There was no jeopardy because there was no promotion and relegation. You were playing the same sides over and over again, and they're not the sides that you have a massive relationship with, and you're not going to go to every away game because they're all over the, they're all over Europe. And it's that combination of things as a sporting feature made it not work. And if the Super League was something different, so the Premier League, I mean, as a sporting endeavour, the Premier League was structured to make money, obviously, but as a sporting endeavour, it worked. Just lob off a couple of the teams, so there's a bit less football, but otherwise it's the best teams in England playing against each other with jeopardy because there is promotion and relegation. The league's still quite big, still enough teams in it to make it sensible, and that works as a sporting endeavour, so that enables people to get behind it, whereas the Super League, it doesn't speak to people's souls in the same way, whereas the Premier League, it's much easier to hold your nose because ultimately you're getting to see your team go around the country and compete against other people from around the country, and it has that atmosphere in the country of the football's on.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't have that with any kind of pan-national, supranational affair.
See, I'm just like sceptical of the idea that like football sort of found its soul that week during the Super League. I think that what you say there, that the format was just bad, the competition was bad, was the main reason for that, rather than football finding itself and for something that and that being something that we can cling to now in this sort of moment?
It doesn't have to be one or the other. And it definitely, it gets to a point where enough people care about something, then the government are obviously going to weaponise it for gain.
Or somebody could weaponise it against the government. That's what I'm astounded that nobody has looked at what happened with the Super League, is looking at what's gone on with Abramovich and come forward and said, now's our time. I'm going to rally everybody who's a football fan and say, get behind us. Here's the plan. This is how it's going to look. I realise there's legal loopholes, but actually, you know what? All the great ideas are considered completely batshit crazy until they're achieved and everybody goes, oh, why didn't we do this years ago?
It absolutely can be done. What you would require, as we said, the political pressure and the political pressure that creates the political will. There's not going to be political will from Boris Johnson to take on Abu Dhabi at this point. There would have to be a very obvious, very significant gain for him to do that. Because as we saw with City's case with UEFA, they will lure it into oblivion. And no government wants to really get involved in that or face the prospect particularly of getting beaten by a sovereign state in court. And arranging for that to happen would require a lot of political will, whereas the Super League, because I mean, I think it was Miguel Delaney's story where the government were involved in the first instance in getting the Super League to where it got to. They were backing it. It was only when they realised the extent of the uproar that they decided actually this is something we better oppose, because that's that this particular, also this particular Tory government, are not just as cruel as the Tory governments of my childhood, but the Tory governments of my childhood, they were obviously very easy to dislike. But the people within them actually had some intellectual heft. They had some gravitas. They represented something. You might not have liked Margaret Thatcher, but believe you knew what Margaret Thatcher and her acolytes stood for. Current Tory government is very different. Boris Johnson wrote two articles about, and this is just the example of Brexit, pro-Brexit and anti-Brexit, before deciding what he was going to do. Liz Truss changes her mind more often than she changes her clothes. And the difficulty with these particular set of ministers is that they don't stand for anything beyond their own power, because they keep changing what they think depending on the blowing of the wind.
Yeah.
So it's very difficult to pin them down on anything. And because of that, there'll never be a principle that they will fight for, unless just on account of the fact that it is a principle.
Yeah.
There will have to be a net political gain for them. And with all that's going on at the moment, although you might think that sorting out the football would be... some people, if you took Manchester United off the Glazers, you would definitely please many, many people. But then you've got to think, well, how many of those people are going to vote for the Tory party? Not that many, because United's in Manchester, and there aren't very many Manchester seats. There aren't very many Tory seats in Manchester City Centre. There aren't any.
No, okay, fair enough. It is depressing, and there's an existential crisis hanging over the world at the moment, and we probably need the diversion of the games at the weekend to take our mind off things in that context.
But that's it, isn't it? Like that's exactly it. There is nothing like football. Football is the greatest diversion, misdirection, masking agent that there is. If, I don't know, if religion was the opium of the masses, football is the ecstasy of the masses.
Florida versus Abu Dhabi, I cannot wait Sunday afternoon.
Oh, it's the feel-good story of the spring.
What's going to happen?
Pick that segue out. it is... I don't know. It's a weird thing, because United's results recently have obviously been rubbish. They've been dreadful. But United's performances have been good. Again, like they panicked in the last 15 minutes. I mean, they're only Watford, obviously, but they panicked in the last 15 minutes where they didn't get a goal. But prior to then, they played fast, incisive attacking football, as they had done against Borough, as they had done for a half against Burnley, and couldn't score. I think it's got to the point for Ralf Rangnick where if Ronaldo was any other player, he'd have been dropped quite a few weeks ago. He's not playing well. And the thing that I didn't expect him to expect to go is the finishing. And the finishing's gone. So even, because with Ronaldo, you might think, well, you just tell him to play within the width of the posts. Like, there's enough going on around him now. United are playing well enough. For the first time in years and years, they're creating loads of chances and they're not conceding that many chances. Now, it's fair to note also that they've had a pretty good run of opponents here. But I think one of the things that will determine what happens in this game is really not that much to do with football at all, and it's in the minds. Because the way that United played in the first half against Atletico aren't a particularly good team. They're not in form. Fair enough, they scored an unbelievable goal. But it was a collective bottle job of intensely tame proportions from United in that first half against Atletico, where they couldn't respond to just a little bit of pressure and a little bit of effort on the part of the other team. With about 20 minutes to go, United realised, hang on a sec, if we put in effort here, we're good enough to win. Now, if they do that against City, the game will be over. And City are a better, more intimidating side to play against than Atletico. Atletico just ran around a lot, put United under a bit of pressure at the back. City won't do that. City will win the ball high up the pitch and you'll struggle to get it back until there's been an attempt on goal. And if United have that collective bottle job again, they'll get absolutely whacked. And it won't matter when they suddenly decide that actually they don't mind participating in a physical, mental contest, because the game will be over. So obviously the most likely result is City win by two or three goals, easing up. But if United play as well as they played in the last few weeks at their best, then it'll be a game.
Is the Spurs performance and the template that they had to beat City, it's not immediately copyable, but there's certainly elements of it that Manchester United have that they can do to Manchester City, and no reason to suspect that Manchester City will learn from that, because that's not, that hasn't been the habit. They've tended to continue doing the same thing, but just trying to do it better.
Yeah, that City, if you can get the ball into good areas, City give you chances. And the reason why Pep Guardiola has only won the Champions League with the greatest midfield of all time, probably the greatest player of all time, is because, what, to me, the main reason is because of the way that he plays. When it works, it's the hardest style of football to beat because you have so little of the ball and you're under pressure the whole time. But in order to play that way, that City have defenders whose primary attribute is their ability as footballers, really, rather than their ability as defenders. So with Barcelona, he was able to get away with it because the midfield was so good and the retention of the ball was so good. And in emergencies, they also had Messi. And whereas with Bayern and City, he's not quite had that. And so they will always give you a chance. I mean, whichever centre-back he plays, Laporte isn't quick, Stones isn't quick or strong, doesn't always concentrate that well, Cancelo's always trying to go forward. So there will always be a chance to score, as Spurs found. And as United beat City on this weekend, actually, last season, quite comfortably. They beat them 2-0 at the Etihad. They beat them quite comfortably. And they beat them at the Etihad the season before as well. Again, like, not comfortably, but dominated them in the first half without having the most more of the possession, but dominated the first half against them and took the game away. So United absolutely have the players to cause City trouble. The problem that they're finding at the moment is they can't score. And it probably has got to the point where Ronaldo, I mean, it got to the point weeks ago where Ronaldo has to be dropped. What I actually mean is it's got to the point where Rangnick almost doesn't have a choice but to drop him. But if you drop Ronaldo, there will just be fuss and aggravation that you don't want. But if you drop Ronaldo for the derby, particularly when you don't have a lot of options, I mean, really, if you're not able to leave Ronaldo out, what do they do? Marcus Rashford's playing dreadfully as well. So you either go 3-5-2 and you play Elanga up front with Sancho, or you've basically got to play Bruno Fernandes as a false nine. So that's both of those are tactical changes away from the formation that's kind of working, even though the results aren't working. So United absolutely have the players to cause City problems, but City are obviously a much better team who are playing better, so you would expect them to win.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. Daniel, great to have you with us this morning. Thanks.
Cheers, lads. Have a good day, everyone.